Dear Asian Girl, for Asian girls, by Asian girls. Hello everyone, I'm Nana speaking. I'm here with Isabel today, and today our guest, we discuss the publishing industry, specifically being able to increase the representation of minorities in the publishing industry. We have with us here Jenny Choi. So Jenny Choi is a marketing director at Li & Lo Books. Li & Lo Books is a family-run publishing company that's been running for over 30 years. Their focus emphasizes minorities that aren't typically represented by in the mainstream publishing industry, hence they're known for their very thorough, meticulous research. So a bit about the context and the history of it. It was opened in 1991 by Tom Lo and Philip Li, who were very disappointed and disillusioned by the lack of representation they saw in children's books. So they worked towards this, and one of the first books they published actually was Baseball Saved Us. And I was so interested in seeing this book because, for one, I think as readers, as someone who loves to read, who has Goodreads as one of their apps on their phone, I think when you grow up not really seeing such beautiful, for example, Asian representation in books, you forget to realize like it's actually possible to have this integrated so well into our society. So with Baseball Saved Us, actually, it's a book, it's a children's book, but the backdrop of it is like Japanese Americans and the attack on Pearl Harbor and internment camps, which you would never truly think of to be the backdrop of a children's book, because one, it's a very traumatic, very emotionally tied experience, but it's also so quote unquote niche and not very mainstream in a mainstreamed way represented. So it's just one of the many achievements and many great things that Li & Lo Books are doing. In 2010, they extended their branches to be more towards young adult readers as well by opening two books, recognizing that children books are not the only ones that are missing representation, that require representation. And obviously, you know more about the progression of Li & Lo Books. So why don't you take it away from here, introduce whatever I may have missed out, and just explain the overall aim and what Li & Lo Books is trying to accomplish.
So my name is Jenny Choi. My pronouns are she, her. I am Native Hawaiian, Chinese, and Okinawan. I'm originally from Hawaii. I've been working in publishing for over 15 years now across a couple of different publishers. And I'm currently at Li & Lo as their marketing director. Yeah, you really did a great introduction. There's not a whole lot I can add, just to say that, you know, we have added a couple of other imprints over time, most recently Cinco Puntos Press. And really with Li & Lo, we are, you know, it's really important for us, like it's particularly for our imprints, to preserve the that name and that legacy. So that's why you won't see them like just become Li & Lo branded books. They become like part of our the history that we're building here. And I think that's like a really important thing. I feel like people of the global majority often refer to, you know, the people that come before them. And this is like one really thoughtful step that I think Li & Lo does.
Yeah. For people who don't know what imprints are, could you explain what an imprint is?
Oh, yes. I just launched right into publishing jargon, so thank you for stopping me there. So an imprint is typically within, there's like, you know, you have your kind of overarching company name, and then within that, there may be certain lines that kind of specialize in different kinds of things. So our two books is mostly going to be any kind of novels, you know, anything that, any kind of chapter books really, and goes all the way up to, you know, 18 and plus, for some books. So that's really what an imprint is. I know most people are like, it's just okay to know that, you know, this is Li & Lo, this is Random House, this is, Macmillan Books. Like, that's totally fine. That's definitely publishing jargon that I don't expect a lot of people to know.
Yeah, in our research, I encountered the concept of imprints, and that was actually something I wasn't sure if it was used a lot in the publishing jargon, because a lot of people just use the publishing company as an overarching umbrella for all the imprints.
Yeah, I think it's more of an internal way that we organize ourselves and sort of, you know, budget allocations, things that are like super boring necessary as well.
And I think this is kind of a natural segue to get into how you got into publishing and what prior experience do you have to the position you have now.
Yeah. I didn't really realize publishing was a thing that anyone could do until after I graduated college. And that was back in 2005. And so I've been in publishing for, you know, like over 15 years now at this point. And I really truly did not have any idea until I did an internship. I saw that I went to school in Boston. And my my career pages was like, oh, there's an internship at this children's publisher in Somerville, Cambridge, called Candlewick Press. And I was like, well, maybe I'll like do my hand at that. And I had a summer internship with them. And, you know, that summer internship was like a lot of, I was in their library a lot. They have an in-house library where you can pull books if you need to send them out. And I was basically like the manager of this library. It was really big and huge. It really allowed me to like really learn their books really well and to be like, this book gets requested all the time. And so it made me curious about like, why do they keep sending out this book? So it was a really great way to learn their list. And really that was my foot in, and I'm like really grateful to Candlewick for that introduction, because from there I was able to, you know, get a job at another small publisher, also based in Boston, Charles Bridge Publishing, where, mm-hmm. you know, I first dipped my toes into sales and marketing specifically. But yeah, and it was just kind of like snowballed from that, because I eventually went back to Candlewick. I've had the good fortune of working on mostly small publishing houses. Little Brown Books, Your Own Readers is part of Hachette. So that's like the biggest publisher that I've worked for, but even they felt like smaller, you know? So that's sort of been my career. So I don't have a lot of experience at, you know, what you would call your like typical big five, aside from my time at Hachette. But publishing's been certainly not a path that I had any experience in before. I was a print journalism major, and I'm just kind of looking for like, how can I apply my skills? And I think there are so many, from any background can really like publishing would benefit from anyone from any background. But I also know that it is kind of a tough industry to break into.
Yeah, 100%. Since like you described like your internship, you were literally surrounded by these plethora of books. You start to know them front and back. So do you like to read? What is your relationship with reading? And I know that you started out with your major being print journalism. So this wasn't always like a cookie cutter clear, like, oh, this is like my end goal and aim, what my trajectory will look like. So I guess, how did your aims along the path of your career sort of change, and what really made you want to pursue specifically publishing? Like, what was sort of a turning point that told you, I am interested and drawn towards this?
Yeah, I think sometimes too, when we're kind of early in our career, we're not really sure. So we're kind of just taking advantage of the opportunities that come our way. So that is admittedly, I wish I could say I was a little more intentional in the path that I took. But yeah, truly, it was like I was I'm just as surprised as anyone else is that I'm working in publishing. That was not something that I expected. I wasn't, I will say, not even to this day, I'm not a terribly strong reader. I'm a pretty slow reader, as a matter of fact. I would say it takes me a lot of time, but that's okay, you know, like I'm totally fine with that. For me, in terms of like books and making like sort of the most intentional choice I've made in my career is actually joining the In Low, I will say. I am the newest member of the team here. So I've only been I just made a year in September. And this is a really intentional choice that I made based on how I was feeling in terms of the publishing industry and sort of what I've experienced and observed, the 15 plus years that I've been doing this work. And I really, for me, it was a choice in terms of like, I wanted to work for a company that was really aligned with my own personal beliefs. And that's essentially what brought me here. So I would say of all the choices that I've made, me being at Lee & Low is the most intentional one.
So could you explain a bit more about your role at Lee & Low and what the role of a marketing director entails, just to give some context to our listeners?
the market. So just like in terms of, because I think one thing that people often, that I see people often confuse is sort of what is the difference between marketing and publicity? Like we are very, we're like cousins, but we're not the same. So we're very intricately tied to one another. We work really closely as teams, but we're not exactly the same thing. So when I think of publicity, I think of sort of what you can get that is giving your book exposure or your author exposure for free. It takes a lot of work to do that. Obviously, you pitch like 500 different places and people, and maybe you get five hits from that, right? Organic hits that come through that generate coverage. So that's how this is a really simplified version of what publicity is. And then comparatively to marketing, a lot of marketing is paid promotion. So when you go into your Barnes & Noble and you see on the table, there are like books that are face up on those tables, likely the publisher paid to have them there. And that's sort of Yeah. So it's called co-op. So it's like these kinds of things where we're intentionally investing our dollars to get them in a slightly better place so an average consumer can pick them up. And even things too, like on Amazon's website where you're like, you might like these too. Some of the, you know, like some of those functions are paid functions. And then oftentimes we find too, because one of the things that I've seen sort of over time in my career is that there's sort of less and less opportunities to pitch your authors, like speak on a panel, be part of this event. And we are finding at least, you know, like that a lot of times it's kind of a pay to play deal. So you'll sign up for a free, this free event, you'll go to this free event and like, but knowing that like, you know, publishers have had to like, in addition to maybe getting the author there, we've also maybe had to pay like some extra money to even be part of that conversation in the first place. So so that's the general distinction that I just want to draw in terms of marketing versus publicity. That's how I see it playing out in my day-to-day. But for in terms of the like what the your marketing like a marketing team is doing just generally is we are like the public facing kind of department that is liaisoning between a lot of different internal departments. So like, you know, we're talking really a lot with our editors, sort of, you know, about the book, about what kind of expectations an agent or an author may have themselves, you know, and how do we manage those expectations. We're working with designers to be like, okay, I'm running this ad. I want it to look like this. And there is like kind of a language you have to talk like to your designer to get the end product that you're looking for. So it's kind of negotiating like that other language you have to learn as well. And then too, we're working with, you know, sales teams in like a wide variety of capacities. And like, they have a lot of different requests from a lot of different clients or accounts that you're wanting to like really hit the mark for. So we're kind of like working across many, many different departments. It was like the marketing is sort of marketing and publicity is sort of where they all converge at here. Yeah. So that's what our team is doing, sort of like on a day to day all the time. We're like talking with and like trying to figure out what our best process is for bringing the book out to the general public, so you can pick it up in your wherever you buy books or wherever you pick the books. So
yeah. So are you at all part of how like publishing companies will like pick a book to take on?
Yeah. So the marketing team is generally a part of that process. We and not every member of the team will be part of that process. Some companies are way more transparent about what's on their docket, and some are less transparent. So it just sort of depends where you work. That's what I found in my experience. But typically you do have a say. You kind of like – you do chime in to say, oh, I hear teachers and educators ask me for this all the time. You know, so we do have a say in sort of like knowing like a temperature gauge in terms of what we're hearing from, you know, the people on the ground that we're working that are working with young readers. So we do have a say in that. I will say that I think in my experience of it, sales has a bigger weight on the scale of that than marketing does. We do our best. You know, I really you know, my previous store I worked at Abrams and you know, like I really felt like I would have to go to the bat sometime, like down to the mat, you know, to like advocate for a book that I felt like this is like, we don't see this any kind of book out here. And this adds so much to the conversation. So I think one of the flaws sometimes of the, often it's called the acquisition process or acquisitions, is that's what we call when we're talking about books we're going to acquire. And we're acquiring them like pretty far out, right? So it's like, could be some books like 5 years before they even see bookshelves. And in some cases longer than that. So in a way you're kind of having to predict a little bit where the market is or where, you know, you think people's interest may lie. So you take a little bit of risk in that sense. But we also have this system that I think is like really flawed. It's called like comp titles and their comparative titles. So this book reads like, I don't know, Percy Jackson books or something. It's a really flawed system because if you're like, there's nothing actually quite like this, you know, like sales is unsure of like how they're going to bring it to market. And it's just like, they, you know, so it's like this, it's just a really flawed way of trying to like estimate what a book might do.
Do you think there's an alternate solution to that?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. And I wish, I wish I knew. I will say that I've sat in like on a few acquisitions meeting here at Lienlo, and the pressure around acquisitions is very different. We have more freedom here because our list is significantly smaller, but we have a lot more freedom here for our editors to sort of be like, this is the book that I really want to work on, I really want to bring to market. And so I think that is a totally different dynamic. It also makes it like a lot less capitalistic kind of pressure for a book to, you know, like, be a bestseller. I mean, obviously there are tools, like there are ways to do that. It'll cost you a pretty penny, but you can certainly do them.
I think, I mean, again, like you mentioned, the risk of every acquisition, like every single investment in a book is its own unique risk, especially when you're so drawn to the specific book. So like, bring out this representation that's so beautiful and so niche and new. Every new thing that we do is going to be hard. Every new thing is going to be like something, like a foreign thing that we're tapping into. So I think it's this just trap that we fall into between like being practical and then also trying to like achieve new things and be able to, you know, achieve like the small dreams of like children out there who want to see themselves represented. I think it is a very difficult thing to balance, especially with like the importance of, you know, trying to also like meet your gains, meet your profits. So I understand it's very hard trying to like find like good medium ground. So I wanted to ask you, in terms of when you are looking on to take a specific book, or not even like a specific book, I guess, when you're talking about like marketability of books in general, what do you see like in terms of what you gauge with teachers or people on the ground, or just people in general, like the public audience? What topics sell, and also who really gets to say in if a group will publish the book?
Saleability of a book is something that comes up all the time, right? And there's this like old saying that I used to hear all the time, which is basically like there was a lot of language like, oh, that's too niche, that's too blah, blah, blah. And it's like, what are you saying? Like, queer Black readers are niche, you know, like what, you know, like, so I think, you know, there was this idea in publishing for a long time that any underrepresented identity was, you know, not something that would be a big hit, you know, and thankfully we're seeing that change over time now. The numbers are getting a little bit better, at least in the books that we see published, and who they're by, and the voices that are coming out there. But certainly publishing's workforce in and of itself, not a lot of change there, unfortunately. So it's like it's a really big systemic problem that our industry and many, many others have. We're not unique by any stretch of that imagination. So we do talk about that all the time. I think we're trying to many of us, many of course, BIPOC, queer folks are all trying to remind people that there's always going to be a seat at the table, that, you know, nobody is a monolith. And just because I tell my AAPI story doesn't mean it looks the same as that person over there. We all have different things to contribute and tell. So I think for publishing as a whole, it's about reframing about, like, what do we add when we bring in this story, you know, as opposed to, like, how does this fit in into, like, all the existing puzzle pieces we have already?
Yeah, books should just be made for enjoyment and to, like, see ourselves, yeah.
Ideally, right. But yeah, so there's it's a really delicate balance that we put out there. And I think too, like, as consumers, sometimes we underestimate our own power in that sense of where we spend our dollars, how we spend that money. Mm-hmm. Because that is one way to definitely show a company that, hey, look at this. This is totally profitable. And it's replicable in any number of ways. So we shouldn't also forget our own power as individual consumers of what we can bring when we make really intentional choices. Like, you know, like for me, I don't shop at Amazon at all. Like, that is a real choice that I'm making. And I know that I'm just one person in this little puzzle. But at least that's something I feel like I have control over, you know?
Yeah, and I feel like that's something that we constantly talk about in a lot of our podcast episodes, is even though we're one person, our choices can have that ripple effect, and our choices can influence our friends and our family and our communities. We're not limited to just ourselves, and I love that. Recently, I think I've seen a lot of independent booksellers on my Instagram reels. And I think it's so cute, because it's just like, it's so nice to see that, like, the people who are, like, reviewing all those books, like, on Book Talk or whatever, you know, they're like buying them from from, like, independent stores, not Amazon.
Yeah. From their own community. Like, that's an important thing, is community building. It's more than just, like, I mean, I understand that price points are, you know, like things like Amazon make things really easy and fast, and you know, some affordability, but, like, there's nothing, you can't really recreate what an independent bookseller can bring to a community, or, you know, and your library as well. And so that sense of community there, that is sort of like coming to you, not necessarily at the cost of something else.
And also the independent booksellers around at least back in Boston, they tailor
Pittsburgh
their...
Pittsburgh has some good ones, too.
Oh, really? Wait, I would love to hear some suggestions.
No, I was just going to say, I'll have to, like, look up... I just want to make sure I get their names right. But they definitely have some good bookstores there, too. So, and a lot of communities. Just look out for them.
Yeah. Okay. We'll touch on this towards the end as well with the conclusion. But, okay, we're putting a bookmark in this. Oh, my gosh.
Wait, you're getting excited. You're, like, all riled up now.
No, I'm so excited because I love going to independent booksellers, and they always tailor their suggestions to their readers and what kind of sells. And that's one of the reasons why I was inspired to, like, put this episode into the brainstorming pool, because books are so important and the bookstores are integral to communities. And I know at least in Boston, there's a lot of, like, college students and a lot of bookstores, and a lot of them, I can kind of see now that you bring up that people pay to put stuff on the tables. I can kind of see it, because I've read some books and I was like, this is just a personal opinion, but I didn't like them that much. And I'm like, are we really recommending, like, this book? But hey, anyways, that's just my personal opinion. Back to, our previous conversation about why representation is so important, and sometimes it can be hard to, like, move that needle. Did you ever see yourself represented in books when you were younger? And if so, in what ways?
This is a really good question. So I am from Hawaii. I'm Hawaiian as well. And so where I grew up, I will admittedly say, also, I grew up in, like, the 80s and 90s, so I did not see myself reflected often in books. Probably like one of the few books that I saw myself reflected in is a cringe book. It was The Five Chinese Brothers. I don't know if either one of you have seen it, but it is like now as a girl, looking back, I'm like, damn, that was like some crazy shit to internalize as a young person in terms of what Asian people are depicted as. But one really amazing benefit of me growing up in Hawaii is that books weren't my only source of seeing myself reflected. I saw myself reflected everywhere, all the time. And so I didn't need books as a source for that window, right? Mm. So that's like from Rudine Sims Bishop, credit. I always want to give credit to her whenever I bring that up, like windows, mirrors, and sliding glass doors, yes, in terms of how we see ourselves, yes, in books and how we see other people. So I fortunately, like, books were not my only place where I could see myself reflected. So a lot of times the books I was reading were, you know, about someone else's experience, out of Green Gables, like Night, you know, like these are all books that were important for me to read. And to understand how other people in the world function. But yeah, I the wealth of books that are out there now for kids to read, I'm like so jealous. But then it's wild too, because like the same old books are being read over and over and over again, right? So like To Kill a Mockingbird is still being read. Like, this is like,
gosh.
Yeah, yeah. I think I've told the story before on this podcast about how my eighth grade English teacher, who is Latin American, I respect him so much. I think I like emailed him like a year later or so, and there's a reason. I think we had to write an essay about like a teacher that inspired us. I think I did him. I emailed him. He was like, "Thank you so much," because what he did was really try to bring representation to our classroom. The syllabus in my school typically focused on To Kill a Mockingbird. But rather than having a white author's representation be, again, continuously proliferated, he brought out this book, Homegoing by Yao Jiaxi, who I believe was, is Ghanaian, I believe. I'm pretty sure if I'm accurate. And it's so much more, for one, raw. The research is so thorough and so much more meticulous, and it's also drawing from her own background, her own like experience with her generational stories in her family. There's some inspiration there, and of course with like historical aspects, and it's just so much more authentic and a much better and more beautiful way of telling the story. So yeah, it's just, that's my mini rant on To Kill a Mockingbird, but please continue.
Kudos to your teacher for like, you know, like for really like pushing his administration to change things, because I think sometimes that is the hardest part.
And there was quite a lot of backlash is an intense word, but there was a lot of resistance in a way, in a small shape or form, because the book Homegoing, it does go into like some graphic things because of the slave trade and like the trigger warning, the sexual assaults that women would go through, black women would go through in the slave trade. So obviously, as we are eighth grade students, though, we are most likely have been exposed to these concepts, these traumatic themes before. So a lot of parents were very hesitant, but there was the sense that this wasn't the only reason the parents were hesitant, you know? More raw, realistic portrayals of slavery in America have always been quite hard to come by, especially in curricula. So I think you can see that it's much more of a bigger issue than we want to keep our kids safe and, you know, keep them like under this, you know, guise of like comfort, you know what I mean? So there's a lot of depth to go into there, but that's just, you know, one of the many reasons that talking about representation and pushing for representation is so important, because the stories that we uplift and choose to highlight are so impactful on young minds, especially.
Totally. And I feel like everything you just said is sort of like, you know, this is what we're seeing too in the conversation in terms of banning books and censoring them. Like, that this is the same thing, right? It's like banning books and, you know, the hubbub about like teaching a like true history of this country, the assault on LGBTQ rights all across this country. These are all related to each other. They're not separate.
So I think talking about again, the importance that representation has in communities, do you think that when being sort of a proponent, like for yourself, being a proponent of representation for young children, sort of healing for like the inner child inside of you. I know that you were able to find representation in other forms and mediums outside of books, but I think, I don't know, is there some sort of like healing or like benefits that you yourself are experiencing?
Yeah, I think there definitely are. I feel like, you know, a healing journey is like one that is not necessarily linear. And also it's like kind of one of those things too, where it's like, all I'm really trying to do is just be a better citizen of the world. And part of that is like healing myself and like confronting my own biases and understanding that. And I think that's really what publishing, one of the big benefits that I have gotten out of publishing as an industry myself is, you know, so someone who, there's not a lot of me in the room a lot of the time, with the exception of Lee and those, is that I've never worked in an office where there's majority BIPOC folks. So that's one interesting thing. But to say that it's really allowed me to kind of understand how I'm perceived in the world by other people, and also how I perceive other people as well, and what the baggage I bring to the table that I don't even realize sometimes, right? Because that's part of my problem is like, oh gosh, I didn't even know that that was a problem. So it's allowed, like, I've learned so many incredible things working in children's publishing, and too, like, working, like, I will say the amount of things I've learned from nonfiction picture books, incredible. Like, I cannot even, like, these are topics that I would not even truly have understood or like even known about if it wasn't for me getting the opportunity to work on these books. So I think particularly I have a soft spot in my heart for picture books, because I think they really, because of the economy of like space on the page, that it's 32 or 40 pages. You really have to be precise with your language and what you're trying to convey, and same for the art as well. And I think there's a lot of richness that can be found in those books in particular. So I always want to remind people about, like, I know, you know, we all want to pick up a big fat book and it makes us feel super intellectual, but don't discount those picture books.
Yes. Because
they can teach you so much.
Yes. I was talking to Naina right before this meeting about a children's book I just read, or I read a couple months ago, called The Most Beautiful Thing. I'm not sure if you've heard of it. But, and, I mean, the illustration is so rich. And it's about a grandchild's relationship with her grandmother. And the grandmother and her children, so the girl's mother and father immigrated to the United States. And it's just talking about how much she loves, or how at first she encountered a lot of, I guess, gripe with her parents and her grandmother, and how over time things really changed in her family. But then in the end, she kind of understands her family's immigration story, and she understands there's this image of her grandmother's feet because she washes her grandmother's feet, and there's cracks in her feet and there's blisters in her feet. And it's just so emotional. It's some of the most beautiful illustration, and I'm sure we'll link it somewhere. And I'll definitely want to share that, but it was so, I mean, it's a children's book. I definitely discounted children's books previously, but this book touched me in a way. I mean, it was kind of reminiscent of my family's immigration story, so I guess it was extra personal in that sense. But the illustration and the words, and there's not even that many words. Like, there's like maybe 10, 15 words per page, which is, I think that's almost harder than writing one of those big fat books, right? Because you have to convey things in emotion. And I mean, not that big books don't do that, but you got limited. Like you said, there's like only 30, 40 pages. And yeah, it's just so striking to me. And it's so great that like kids now can see that story for themselves, because definitely I grew up with the little caterpillar book and like The Good Night Moon, which is, they're all good books. They're all good books. Don't get me wrong.
All the same books. Like, we all have this reference point.
Yeah.
There are all many good ones that we could be referencing
right,
later.
Right, right. And I guess, like, do you see the psychological benefits of children seeing representation of themselves in novels? Like, does Lee and Lo process that, and like, do they have like statistics on that, or do you guys ever talk about that within your organization?
Yeah, I mean, we talk about like the importance of diverse books all the time, and particularly right now in the, you know, current climate
right.
of this that's going on in this country, just reminding people of our books can bring to the table. So we definitely talk about this often, right? So it's just not some, you know, it's about wanting to inspire kids to be the authors of their own stories, like understanding that we do have that ability and power. So that's one thing. I think too is like, at any time you feel really seen, like where you feel seen, that is a really overwhelming feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, I can never describe the moments where I feel incredibly seen.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, I don't have words for them, but there is certainly a feeling behind it. And I think I don't think we could possibly measure what that is, especially as a young person. Like, I'm talking only like as an adult, you know, where I've experienced that. But I think right now it's like, we know what books can do for us in such a really safe way. It shows us other people's experiences, and we can really what it is to build empathy and build understanding, and what it is to try to understand somebody else's position that's not us. Like, how do we not, you know, center ourselves in just our own experience, which are important things, but it just really expands your world in like tremendous, tremendous ways. Lee and Lo doesn't track these statistics ourselves, but there are a ton of great nonprofits that do just this. So First Book is one great one who just actually released a study recently on the topics of what it is to have books, diverse books available in a classroom setting. So one thing that is kind of a known fact across publishing, is like unrefuted, well-known thing, is that, you know, if you have books in your home, you are more likely to excel sort of, you know, in an academic sense, in a professional sense, because you have access to this in your home. But of course, the books are a luxury, right? They're not the roof over your head. They are not the food on your plate. So we also recognize that that affordability is an issue when it comes to this factor. So we have like played in that way, but like, books do nurture us in a totally different way than our shelter, than our food. And what the First Book study found was basically like, when kids are given or have this access to books that really reflect themselves and their experience, their communities, they read more. Like, duh,
yeah,
right?
Like, yeah,
yeah. So I think about how like I'm like a slow reader, but I'm just like, well, could I have been a faster reader if I had like Grace Lynn, you know, like writing for me
love Grace Lynn.
Yeah, she's the best.
Oh,
yeah.
I was so lucky. In the Scholastic book, like, book fair, do you guys know what that is? I feel like like elementary school, or like most elementary schools, like will have like that little like book fair. Like, it was like, I like the used books, and I would find like any Grace Lynn book, and I'd be like, oh my gosh, like, I need to get this, because, and I don't think I realized it until like later on, I wanted it because I was like, I relate to this. I like eat the same food that these characters are eating. And I don't know. I mean, you can see like how happy I am about it now, but
it's just the energy.
Like,
world
what I'm
coming
saying.
Forth.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Where the mountain meets the moon, like, oh, that was so good. And like the picture books, like seeing the food that I ate in a book, like the Dim Sum for Everyone book, that one, oh my gosh, like, I'm so excited. That book was,
you gotta,
like,
pick up her new book. She's got a new book, it's called Chinese Menu.
You're gonna check it out.
Yes. I saw
that. You've already seen it then.
I follow her on
yeah,
Instagram.
Yeah.
You know,
she's a good follow.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we don't keep that, but other people do. Lee and Lo does. We do keep tabs on the publishing workforce. So we have our diversity baseline survey, which does a survey across as many publishers that there are in terms and asking about basic things like race, age, gender, ability, all of those things. So we're trying to get a sense of like what our workforce looks like. And we're also trying to expand that to not just include publishers, because there are so many people within this kind of book ecosystem that we can call in to, right? So anyone that works at like a magazine or publication that does book reviews, right? They're a gatekeeper too. Anyone who's acting in that role of like what gets out there, what doesn't, we're trying to call those in. So it includes literary agents too. So we're a small team here, and we execute this survey, I think, every like 4 years. So we're going to have one in the new year. We're going to release the results of that in 2024. But yeah, so we are keeping tabs of that. And so we sort of let the experts in the working with in the classroom and with young people, they know what they're doing over there. They know the questions to ask. So we like to stay in our lane in a little bit. But I love to cite these organizations because they are doing tremendous, tremendous work.
We will definitely mention them in our description, and they'll be available. And we would love to be able to uplift that. Thank you. So everything that was just said, by the way, I resonate with so much. I think is about my experience, at least with, I think when I was younger, I also didn't, I had more of a type of experience where I wasn't really in the Scholastic Book Fair, I wasn't like running towards books where I felt represented necessarily. For me, it was almost like, because it was so, scarce or sparse, the representation I did see, I was almost very hesitant with it. It was this weird relationship because being seen, yes, it's like exhilarating, but it's also very visceral in a very raw, almost jarring way. Be seen can be so rare for some people, for minorities especially, that when you see for the first time or the first couple times, it's so hard to either accept or to either take in. So I think that's also another process that I want children as young as they can to be able to either bypass or just get through in a way that will just allow them again to have these books in their homes, to just allow them to discover this joy of reading that they may not have otherwise discovered with just Goodnight Moon or Little Caterpillar, whatever the generic set of books are that we see represented time and time again without additional diversity. So I also want to ask you, as I know your time with Lean Low has been roughly around a year, you're a relatively new member. So, but still in terms of the publishing industry, have you seen an upward trend in representation in books that get published, or do you think it's stagnant and the same? And what is Lean Low doing to make up for any gaps that exist?
Yeah, this is a great question. It's interesting because in the time since I've been working in publishing, so 2005, there's always been kind of a thing where it's diverse books. And I did fall into that trap of thinking, oh yeah, I think we've all made it there. We're fine. We don't need. And then that was my, whatever lens I wanted to look at through the world, my rose-colored glasses. With an organization, I don't know if you all are familiar with We Need Diverse Books. I forget when they were founded, but it's been a while. They've been on the scene for a little bit, and they do tremendous work as well in terms of working towards representation, making sure that's front and center. I gotta give a shout out to them, because I think when they came on the scene, my social conscience was really changing as well. So it helped to reframe for me. I think we are seeing overall a difference in the voices that we center, who actually gets to be published. So I think that is a good thing. There's more out there for sure. Could we do a bit better? We definitely could. And hopefully we are. And hopefully the conversations that are happening around banned books aren't changing internal decisions that are being made. So no soft censorship, right? We don't need to censor ourselves to please a small voice of dissenters, essentially, on this topic. So that's one thing that I'm not sure what that looks like in how publisher to publisher. We are seeing like these great imprints that are really BIPOC focused. So like one that I really love is at Penguin Random House. It is Coquila. And they do tremendous, amazing books. But we know also too, like, you know, on the adult end of things, Roxane Gay has her own imprint. Phoebe Robinson has her own imprint. There are like a lot of like, I think we are proving to folks that, you know, we are commercial, we are saleable. And, you know, it does help when we have to like movies, Everything Everywhere, you know, like when there's commercial success on that level, that also like really just helps us, you know, to raise that platform, raise the bar for our own selves. I think probably where we could be doing a little bit better is also considering, I don't know if you guys saw this, but a couple of years back, there was a publishing paid me kind of movement thing going on the internet, where people are like, yeah, well, I got this much of an advance to write this book. And then meanwhile, you know, your white counterpart is like, oh, I got this much, you know? So it's like talking about pay equity, and what we actually give people to make a living. Mm. So we should certainly talk about that as an industry. So we'll see sort of what, you know, what sort of shakes out like as publishing moves on here. You know, I think we saw in the summer of 2020, a lot of publishers, like many other companies, you know, standing in solidarity with the Black community. But it's like, how many of these statements were performative, you know, like, what are you actually really doing to support, like, you know, Black people, Black communities? So, and I think that's something we should constantly ask ourselves. We're not ever done with that work. Mm. It's always going to be there. And like, and it's not just to like writers and illustrators, but it's also to like independent booksellers that are BIPOC owned, that are queer owned. Like, those are all part of it too. And then how do we support as well, or try to support to our educators, our librarians, mm-hmm. our teachers, which who are so bless them. But
yes,
they need to be paid more. Like,
yes,
you know, they are doing incredible hard work, mm-hmm. And they are really having to come up against some really frightening things sometimes. You know,
yeah.
So. Yeah, that's all. Those are all sort of like the things I'm seeing in publishing where I'm like, this is certainly improving, but we can do better because we can always do better.
Yeah, and I think this conversation is a little bit under the guise of, you know, do we feel like, you know, BIPOC people are a minority? So I think an important question to answer is, do you believe that the publishing and writing industry is white dominated?
I don't believe it is. It certainly is. Mm. I think like when you look at the diversity baseline survey, it really shows that. So it is for sure. And you know, you run into challenges in terms of how do we make sure that we're centering. I'm talking on like the marketing end. Mm-hmm. Right? So a couple of years ago, I was working on this book from Cherie Dimaline, who wrote The Marrow Thieves. She's Métis. She's from Canada up north. And we were working on the sequel to this book, Hunting by Stars. And our team, I felt like, didn't understand what the message of Cherie's book was. And that was, so I don't know if you know the premise of this book, but it's a sci-fi set in a dystopian future where essentially Indigenous and Native people are being hunted down. And harvested because they're the only people in the world who are still able to dream. And for me, I was just like, well, that metaphor right there is like me not even knowing that publishing is a career path. When we don't even know what our opportunities are, that's what this book was talking about. But like it was totally a missed theme from many of the colleagues that were working alongside me on this book. And I was just like, how do I shed a light to let you know that this is what this person is talking about? But I can't, like, I don't know if your lived experience is not the same as mine or even close to mine. Like, how do I show this to you? You know, like to not even know what your possibilities are, that's a real thing. Like in Hawaii, we don't get like an author to come talk to us. You know, that's not a thing that happens. so like for me, I was just like, oh yeah, like what if I did know that like writing a book was something that I could do? Mm-hmm. So it's always kind of like those, I feel like those are some nuances that sometimes get lost in the publishing world, that like, oh man, we could really like run amok with this, you know, if we really leaned into it.
Mm-hmm. So
run amok in a good way.
Yeah. So I think also another important question is all representation, like all representation minorities, good representation? For example, you think that people who aren't from the backgrounds they're trying to, that they don't belong to, how can they represent that? Or should we be pickier and more demanding with the representation we choose to accept?
I think we should, I think a lot about accountability, and how we can be accountable to one another. And to also just like, not just like, you know, future generations of our one another's. I think anytime we're writing outside of our own lived experience, we should really be putting in a lot of work into making sure that that feels like an authentic thing, that, and also that we are not falling into any kind of harmful tropes or perpetuating harmful stereotypes. So I think that is one thing. So I am A-okay with people writing outside of their own lived experience. I just think you have to really put the work in order to make sure that you've captured it the way it needs to be captured. Because then otherwise, I don't think you really have any business writing that story if you're not going to put all that care into it. You know what I'm saying? It's really... Grace Lynn is a really good example, because she's like has gotten feedback from other Asian people saying, hey, why are your characters always like fair-skinned Asian people? Mm-hmm. And she's like, oh, like she had any thought. Yeah. Like she was like, oh, it's because they look like me. That's why. But, you know, so these are like, I think we always have room for improvement and room to grow. And I was just like, I watched a conversation yesterday with Cynthia Ledick Smith and Angeline Bully, who are both Native creators and authors. And they were really talking about what it is when we also live at intersections. So thanks, Kimberly Crenshaw, for that intersectionality. So it's like talking specifically about Black and Indigenous, and when you live at that crossroads, what that experience looks like for you. And they are talking about how, so they were doing so much care to make sure that, you know, the reader who is really going to see themselves in this feels that, you know, so not just like kind of in a flip way. So
yeah, I definitely noticed that the Grace Lynn books didn't necessarily represent my own experience, but maybe it was because that was one of the few things out there that I could relate to. I really latched onto that. And then as I got older, and maybe it's also like more books came out, but I also was exposed to more books as well. Like that's when, I mean, my first episode on Dear Asian Girl was about Crying in H Mart. We had a whole episode about that book. And that book, I don't think I articulated it well enough on that episode, but that book was one of those books that hit so much that I had to like put it down and stop, because it really brought a lot out of me. And I mean, that's like the power of books and the power of like being able to see different experiences related in literature. And I don't know, maybe I'm also having that moment right now, but but I just think books are so powerful. And kind of building off of like Nana's question from before, like this is a little more lighthearted, but do you think there's any like toxic traits about the major publishing industry?
I love that you called it lighthearted.
I mean,
I think, you know, like publishing, like so many industries, has its own. It's just like sometimes it can be a really tough place for someone when you're, I know for me, like I often felt like I was speaking on behalf of anyone underrepresented. And I was like, we all have access to the internet, my friends. We all have access to the ability to educate ourselves, like, on this thing. And it's like, it's just, it's like, so I feel like that's the thing that for me feels like the most painful sometimes. Mm-hmm. I'm like, yo, we all got access to this. Like, let's be real here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Take the initiative.
Yeah, right.
Like, let's educate ourselves.
Yeah, as opposed to having somebody educate me.
Assume responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, exactly. Like, it's not really that hard, but I guess, you know, it's certainly a shift. So I would say that. I mean, I think there are any number of articles that you can read on the internet talking about how, like, YA was so toxic on Twitter, or, you know, like, there's, like, so many things within publishing that I feel like, you know, it's not necessarily unique. It's just all of us, like, kind of being a little bit petty. But if you really want the real tea on that, you should follow this Instagram account called XOXO Publishing, and you'll get,
I will be dropping a follow. I need to write that down.
I love the name.
Check it out. Take it with a grain of salt there, that, you know, that there's a lot of varying opinions.
Isabel is, like, so shocked. Like
there's 23,000 followers.
It's a movement.
So it's all anonymous. So also remember that, too. So, but, yeah.
That's I'm, like, in utter shock.
It's like the inside scoop.
Yeah, well, yeah. Well, because I'm sure there's a lot of layers to, I mean, as you said, like, there's a lot of layers to the publishing industry, and, I mean, there's definitely a lot, I can imagine there's a lot of characters, and the people who play big roles in the publishing industry, I assume, don't look like me. But maybe that's also something I'm putting onto big industries and capitalism like that, but I don't know. Maybe you can say more about, like, more leadership in big publishing industries, but that's just an aside.
Yeah, we do, like, when we do the survey, at least the last survey that we had, we did see, like, basically the least amount of diversity is in those executive decision-making roles, right? So at the top of a company, and we saw the most, really, in, like, interns. So that is telling, that's very telling in and of itself, is in terms of a number, and being like, what are we doing to retain, historically marginalized people within our workforce? And so it seems like we're not maybe doing a lot, because we're not, like, also considering too, like, all the other emotional baggage that we all have to carry every day into work, you know, and, like, that kind of sucks. So yeah, I mean, certainly we have a long way to go, and I think your assumption is totally right that they don't look like you. And I should also preface this to say that, like, my experience is solely in children's publishing. So I don't know, like, a lot about the adult publishing world. And I imagine that it's probably wildly different than what I'm doing here. So, because we're in terms of colleague stuff, like, we're all pretty friendly with each other, you know? And, you know, if I'm, like, running into an issue, I'll, like, happily just text a friend who works at somewhere else being like, do you have this? Like, what's going on? Like, you know, what's happening there? So we do have those kinds of relationships with one another. And I don't know if that's necessarily true, in other fields or in other parts of this specific industry in and of itself. So there's, like, at least a camaraderie, because also, I mean, I've already said that I've worked at, like, 5 different publishers. So odds are I'm going to have, like, cross paths with a lot of different people. So, and vice versa, right? I never know where I might work with somebody else. So you always want to kind of keep those doors open. Good relationships. That it's good to be. It's good to have solid relationships with people.
Yeah.
I think also just, yeah, having solidarity in general is very important. So, yes, on this note, I think we can conclude. So we've talked a lot about, like, just now we were talking about, like, the roles and the responsibilities we as individuals can play. So I would like to ask, and we touched on this earlier, so I just want to come back to that. You can continue with what you're saying on that, how our listeners, you know, as individual consumers, individual readers, or just individual people who have our own numerous identity facets, how can we all play a role in advocating for better representation of not just Asian people in books, but just any minority, any BIPOC representation or underrepresentation in books?
Right. We all, if one group is oppressed, then we are all oppressed. So I like that framework, framing of that way. I think, you know, it's truly showing up for these books and these creators, so, and also these booksellers. So, you know, make sure to buy, you know, your LGBTQ, your BIPOC books from an independent bookseller. Maybe that independent bookseller is also BIPOC owned or queer owned. So like really just like that is the best way we can support each other and show solidarity in a really kind of like meaningful, tangible way for ourselves. Because it helps that person who is in this community, like continue to do the work that they're doing. In terms of a bookseller, it helps the author or illustrator continue to do the work that they're doing. And it like tells publishers that, hey, this book is like working in the marketplace. This author works in the marketplace. Continue to invest in their stories. Continue to publish them. So I think about like an author like Melinda Lowe, who, you know, recently got a National Book Award. But I know there was like a point in one of the houses that I work for where they're like, I don't know if we could continue publishing Melinda anymore. Her books aren't really selling through. So, yeah. So it's like you just never like we have to have faith and trust in our creators as well. So that's just that anecdotal.
Yeah. Well, I just want to ask you, like, what's your favorite book of all time?
Whoa, that's a tough one. Okay, of all time. I feel like a book recently that I feel like I keep going back to and one that I have read and I think about is certainly the autobiography of Malcolm X. And that book has really kind of really formed me a lot lately. And so that was one I've certainly like honed in on. So it definitely, if you haven't read that one, that is just, it's chunky, but it reads really fast.
We'll be adding it to our list, I'm sure.
We'll become a fast reader for that book.
I was surprised. I was like, oh, I don't know if I'll ever get through this. But yeah, I did. And I'm a slow reader, as I have said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think my pacing is a bit volatile, but yeah, I think whatever I get really excited about that has such a big impact on my pacing, and like, because with Crying Nightmare, like we mentioned earlier, like I just devour that. Like I also was having experiences like I really want to put this down to like emotionally recollect by Kanad. It was like, you know, when you can't look away suddenly, but you just have to. Was,
oh my God! Yes.
Yeah, it was that situation. But yeah, again. I just want to thank you to providing all this information, sharing your insights, and just having such a raw, genuine conversation about the importance and impact of representation in children's books for the media that we are exposed to as like young readers, and how that can even do such great things for us, even in our teenage lives, adult lives. So, yeah, thank you so much. If you have any closing words or any like things you'd like to promote, now would be a great time to do so.
I just want to like really give like make sure everyone just checks out Lee and Lo and our books. I feel like there's a lot of quality there that may be skirting under the radar for people because we are a small publisher, but we are certainly worth checking out, and we are really, you know, taking a lot of risks sometimes in sort of the kind of storytelling that we have. So like one picture book we have is called Connor Kiss Me, and it's a picture book about consent. And it's,
I saw
it's
that
a young girl who
I
is yeah, yeah. So I'm just like, and I don't really see anything quite like that on the market in terms of like, hey, let's talk about this. And also accurate portrayals of how sometimes grown-ups might fail young people, because that's a real thing too. So yeah. Those are all things like might make you uncomfortable, might make you like have, you know, some feelings, but maybe just sit with that.
And children's books can be uncomfortable. I've read children's books with storylines that definitely aren't all like happy-go-lucky, but that's important, I think, because if we paint this picture that everything's okay,
yeah,
then what if it's not okay?
Adulthood will be a rude awakening, so I think...
Not even adulthood for many people. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyways, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Oh, thank you. Thank you guys for doing this. I appreciate being part of it. And Let us know when it's posted, and we'll help share.
Thank you so much.
Have a great day.
You too.
Bye. Bye-bye.
As this episode comes to a close, we'd like to shout out the rest of our team who you don't hear from as often as us co-hosts. Their contributions are integral to the smooth running of Dear Asian Girl, and we would hate to take all the credit for what is truly a huge team effort.
Annika, May, Pavani, Yalda, Anya, and Michaela are our researchers, and Sonia is our audio engineer.
Emma, Prisha, and Claire are our social media writers. Chloe, Kaylee, and Nicole are our social media illustrators.
Alex is our social media manager, and Annette is our podcast manager.
And finally, Ellie is our podcast director. Thanks, team. We couldn't do it without you.